Pull up a chair. I want to tell you about a man who should have died about 6 different ways and didn't, and every time the odds got longer, he just set his jaw and got meaner about staying alive. This is Radio Hanger. I'm Taildragger, and you're listening to The Hanger. Today we're talking about Eddie Rickenbacker. Most of you know the name, America's ace of aces in the First War. But the story that's been rattling around in my head this week isn't about the airplanes he shot down over France. It's about the 8 men on 3 little rubber rafts lost somewhere in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and the seagull that landed on a man's head at exactly the right moment. We'll get there, stick with me. Before we do, today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation Challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up the ladder. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it, and every one of them tells a story that feels right for today, because the man we're talking about earned just about every coin there ever was. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now, let me set the scene. Edward Rickenbacker was born in Columbus, Ohio in 1890. Poor family, German immigrant parents. His father died when Eddie was a boy, and he went to work to feed the family before he was old enough to shave. And what he found, what lit him up, was machinery. Engines, speed. By his early 20s, he was one of the most famous race car drivers in America. They called him Fast Eddie. He ran the Indianapolis 500. He held a world speed record. This is back when a race car was basically a bomb with a steering wheel, and the men who drove them were dying in front of the grandstands on a regular basis. Eddie didn't die. He had this thing, this gift for reading a machine right up to the edge of where it would kill him and then backing off by about a hair. Then the war came, the first one, and here's where it gets interesting. When the United States got into the fight in 1917, Rickenbacker was already famous. Already past the age most pilots started, and the Army didn't want him flying. They wanted him driving. They made him a staff driver, a chauffeur, hauling officers around France in a motor car, General Pershing's outfit. But Eddie had gotten a good long look at airplanes, and he wanted in. He pulled every string he could find. He talked his way out of the driver's seat and into flight training, and then he talked his way into a fighter squadron, the 94th Aero Squadron. You'd know their badge if you saw it, a top hat tossed inside a ring, the Hat in the Ring Squadron. First American squadron to fly combat over the front under its own flag. He flew the SPAD 13. Now picture that airplane for a second, open cockpit. A wooden frame wrapped in doped fabric that you could put your fist through, a water-cooled engine howling about 3 feet in front of your face, throwing back a fine mist of hot castor oil that coated your goggles and your lips and got into everything. The cold up at altitude was savage, no heat, no parachute. The brass back then didn't issue parachutes to pilots because some genius decided a man with a chute might be tempted to leave a perfectly good airplane. Think about that. So you climbed into this thing, freezing, half blind from the oil, your engine liable to quit or catch fire, and you went looking for other men trying to kill you. Rickenbacker was good at it, cold, calculating, the same way he raced. He didn't go in for the glory dives and the wild heroics. He studied it. He'd position himself with the sun at his back. He'd pick his moment, and he'd be gone before the other fellow knew what happened. By the end of the war, he had 26 confirmed victories, aircraft and balloons. More than any other American pilot in that war, the ace of aces. And there was one day in particular, September 25th, 1918. He was out alone, and he spotted a formation. 7 German aircraft. 2 of them were the scouts, the fighters, and 5 were the 2-seater observation planes they were protecting. 1 against 7. And Eddie, being Eddie, didn't go home. He climbed, got his altitude and his angle, came down out of the sun, flamed one of the fighters, then bored straight through the whole formation and knocked down one of the observation planes too. Then he went home. For that, years later, he was awarded the Medal of Honor. So that's the man. Race driver. Ace. National hero. He comes home and he doesn't rest on it. He buys the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. He gets into the airline business and eventually runs Eastern Airlines. Builds it into one of the giants. He becomes one of the most important men in American aviation, period. And the war taught him something he carried the rest of his life. He believed, down in his bones, that the difference between living and dying was almost never the equipment. It was what was between a man's ears. Willpower. Refusing to quit. He'd watched too many good pilots die not because their airplane failed, but because their nerve did. He was about to need every ounce of that belief. Now we jump ahead. February of 1941. Rickenbacker's a passenger on an Eastern Airlines DC-3 coming into Atlanta at night. The airplane crashes short. Tears itself apart in a wooded area outside the field. People die. Rickenbacker is broken nearly in half. Crushed pelvis, broken ribs, driven into a lung, a shattered hip, an eye socket cracked, nerve damage, the works. They pulled him out of that wreckage and frankly didn't expect him to live. He was trapped in the debris for hours, badly injured, soaked in fuel, and he kept talking to the other survivors, keeping them awake, keeping them fighting. The newspapers actually ran early reports that he had died. He didn't die. It took him months and months to put himself back together, learning to walk again, in constant pain. He was still walking with difficulty when the Second War came, which brings us to October of 1942. Rickenbacker, now 51 years old, still hurting from that Atlanta crash, is asked by the Secretary of War to take on a special mission. He's to tour Pacific bases, inspect things, give the men a morale boost, and carry a confidential message by hand to General Douglas MacArthur. A message too sensitive to send any other way. So he climbs aboard a B-17, the Flying Fortress. They take off from Hawaii bound for a tiny island way out in the Pacific to refuel on the long hop westward. And somewhere out over that enormous empty ocean, the navigation comes apart. The instruments were off, the island they're hunting for is a speck, and the Pacific is the better part of the whole planet, and they fly and fly and the fuel needles keep dropping and there's no island anywhere. There comes a moment when the pilot has to say it out loud. We're not going to find it, we're going to have to put her in the water. Ditching a B-17 in the open ocean is a dicey, violent thing. But that crew did it about as well as it has ever been done, set her down on the swells, got everybody out and got three small rubber life rafts, inflated and lashed together before the fortress went under. 8 men, 3 rafts, and 2 of them no bigger than a bathtub, and then the ocean just had them. Picture it now, no land in any direction. The sun comes up and it is a hammer. By midday, the men are blistered, lips cracking and bleeding, tongues swelling. Then the sun goes down and out there on the open water at night, it gets cold enough that they're shivering and clinging to each other. Sharks, big ones, bumping the rafts, rubbing along underneath, their fins cutting the water around them day after day. They had almost no food. A few oranges, Rickenbacker took charge of them, rationing them out in slivers, a tiny piece every couple of days, and the men hated him for it, and he wanted them to. Because here's the thing about Eddie Rickenbacker. He understood from that night in the Atlanta wreckage, and from the war before it, that a man who is furious is a man who is still fighting. So he became the meanest, most cantankerous old buzzard on those rafts. He rode them, he cussed them, he told them they were too soft to die, that he'd outlive every one of them. The younger men lay there ready to give up, and they got so angry at this loud-mouthed old hero that out of pure spite, they decided they'd live just to watch him be wrong. That was the plan. That was him keeping them alive on purpose. Now, here's the part everybody remembers. About a week in, maybe 8 days, no food, no real water beyond what little rain they could catch in their shirts and a rubber sheet. They're done, and Rickenbacker, exhausted, has pulled his hat down over his eyes, dozing, and a seagull lands on his head. A live gull, hundreds of miles from any land, just settles down right on top of him. Nobody moves, nobody breathes. Every man in those rafts is staring at this bird like it's an angel, and in a way it is. And slow, so slow, Rickenbacker reaches up and he catches it. They divided that one gull 8 ways, a few scraps of meat each. And this is the old race driver thinking, the engine man thinking, he used the guts and the bones as bait, tied them to fish hooks they had in the survival kit, and they caught fish. A couple of small fish, a little mackerel, a sea bass. The gull bought them a few more days. A few more days bought them a few more after that. It went on like that. Day after day, the rafts drifting, the men withering away to skin and bone, hallucinating. Some of them slipping in and out. They prayed, they held little services on the rafts, read from a testament one of the boys had, and more than one of those men, hardened young soldiers, said later that something happened out there they could never fully explain. Rain squalls would come right when they were finished praying. One man didn't make it. A young sergeant, Alex Kaczmarczyk, the youngest aboard, had been sick before they even ditched. He faded over the weeks, and one night he slipped away, and they said the words over him and let the sea take him. He was the only one they lost. They drifted for around 3 weeks, 24 days give or take, on the open Pacific. By the end, they had separated the rafts to spread out and improve the odds somebody'd be spotted, and finally, a Navy float plane out on patrol caught sight of one of them, then the others. Search planes had been crisscrossing that whole stretch of ocean for weeks because the brass was not about to lose Eddie Rickenbacker, not the Ace of Aces, not in the middle of a war. 7 men came through, burned black by the sun, starved down to nothing, some of them so weak they couldn't stand. Rickenbacker had lost something like 60 pounds off a frame that didn't have it to spare. But he was alive, and once he'd recovered, the stubborn old goat finished the job. He went and delivered that confidential message to MacArthur. The mission got completed. He wrote about it afterward in a plain, honest way, and so did some of the men who were out there with him, and the accounts line up on the important things. The oranges, the gull, the praying. The fact that one foul-tempered 51-year-old man with a crushed-up body and an iron will more or less refuse to let the rest of them quit. Now here's why I keep coming back to this one. We talk a lot in this hangar about machines. SPAD 13s and Flying Fortresses and all the beautiful iron. But Rickenbacker's whole life is the argument that the machine is only ever half of it. He survived the racetrack, the open cockpit war, a DC-3 torn to pieces in the Georgia woods, and 24 days on a rubber raft in the middle of the Pacific. And not one of those was about having the best equipment. Every single one of them was about a man deciding deliberately that he was not going to die today, and then making the man next to him decide the same thing, even if he had to make him hate his guts to do it. That's a kind of airmanship they don't print in any handbook, but it's the realest kind there is. My thanks to Rickenbacker's own memoirs, including his account of the ordeal, to the records of the National Air and Space Administration's museum, folks at the Smithsonian, and to the Air Force history that keeps these stories straight. If you want to dig into more of these, come find us at radiohangar.com. Eddie Rickenbacker lived to be 72 years old and died in his bed. After all of that, the sea couldn't keep him either. This is Taildragger. Keep the blue side up, and I'll see you next time.